Join me, please, in Ruth chapter 1. As you're turning to Ruth chapter 1, I offer two prefatory observations. First, in a class in Proverbs last Sunday, one of our class members, a veteran school teacher, noted that children like order. I agree. And I offer that profound statement as an epigraph to this lesson. I hope you'll think about how it might fit in with the lesson you're about to hear. Secondly, there may be persons of certain temperaments among us who are miffed or bemused that I take one of the very few books with a woman's name in the title and I changed it to In the Fields of Boaz. Well, I hope you'll think about that too, because this is one of the central parts of the lesson, because it's not really about Ruth. It's not really about Boaz. I'm talking about the fields first and foremost in this. I want you to think about that again. That's a puzzle I hope you'll reckon with. Well, thank you. I hope you're there in Ruth chapter 1 with me. I show you first simply the list of scenes. Chapter 1 is something of a big picture of this story. And then we move to three very specific scenes. One is in the fields, and we'll certainly attend to chapter 2 and what is said there. And then the third chapter, we find the action at the threshing floor. And then in the fourth chapter of the book, the fourth scene is in the gate of the city. So let's look in chapter 1. The opening words there, in the days when the judges ruled. I can't hear the word the judges without summoning to mind, being forced into my mind this awareness, remember, of the cycle of the judges, maybe the downward spiral of the judges, where the people move from oppression to liberation, from languishing to flourishing. And so that's got to be in the back of our mind. And in fact, I think I want to read Ruth as something of a microcosm, a little world inside the larger world of the chaos and flourishing of the judges. In fact, it makes me think of our time. I hope you understand that in our time, we have astonishingly, wonderfully good things happening in our world. We do. And we have astonishingly strange things happening, too. They're both there. So we live amid something that's maybe not unlike this chaos and order, the movement back and forth between the two. Okay. Now you'll notice I put on the slide at the top famine and then harvest. Here in the very first verse, there is a famine. And it may be the famine is associated with that time of languishing, a period of languishing. And in this famine, a family moves out. They leave. And we hear the story. That's setting up the stage for the whole story. But look at the last word of chapter 1. Last word of the chapter is harvest. We move from famine to harvest, or at least the prospect of a harvest. And in between is this story, a story of departure and return. Four people leave, two people come back. Who leaves? A husband and wife and their two sons. And they go to the land of Moab, a strange land. And I want you to know, Moab, it gets repeatedly in this book. We've got to think about that. Why insist on this foreignness? And we'll get there. But in this foreign land where they are, where they reside for quite a while, the two sons marry women of Moab. And so now the family of four has become a family of six. And yet, all the men die. The father who goes dies, and the two sons who married Moab women, all the men die. And so now we have three women. And the mother, Naomi, plans to come back, right? And the two daughters-in-law plan to go with her. And they start out, but they don't both make it back. And I don't say this to fault the one who turns back. Naomi encourages them both to turn back. It makes sense to go back to your families and start anew. What can I do to help you? And so the one daughter, and it's, again, nothing really against her at all. It is a good moment for her to recognize and go back. And yet, for this other, for the one for whom the book is named, Ruth, something else happens. And I want to note the language. These are the most famous verses, right here in the first chapter, most famous verses in the book. In fact, so famous, they end up on wedding invitations sometimes. Which is pretty interesting, because this is not a man talking to a woman or a woman talking to a man. This is a woman talking to a woman. And I want you to see this. It's beautiful. It's powerful. It is the heart of what we're talking about today. Here's what Ruth said. Naomi's already encouraged her and Orpah to go back. And here Ruth says, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And then you said, when Naomi saw that, come on, right? It's astonishing. So here's what, and this is the heart of our lesson right here. Think about what's happening. Ruth says, I want to be part of your life, Naomi. You. I want you. I want your land. I want your people. I want your God. And when she says, "I want your land," she's not trying to take Naomi's land. Naomi doesn't. I want to be part of your world. That's what this book is about. It seems to me that it is about this woman, a foreigner, being brought into the household of God. This foreigner being brought into the people of God. It's an astonishing story. It is covenant talk. Here, Ruth asserts her determination to be joined in covenant, not just with Naomi, but with Naomi's people, Naomi's God. Let's go to chapter 2. Yes, I know the fear going through all four chapters is frightening for a moment, but fear not. We'll make it pretty quick. We're in the fields here in chapter 2. And Ruth becomes a gleaner. She gleans. Some of you farmers may know there used to be a model of harvester called gleaner. But you have to be a certain age probably to know that. Here's a homework assignment for you. You could look up a picture. I know somebody's reaching for their phone already. You could look up a picture, a painting done by a French artist, Jean-François Millet, the 19th century realism, called The Gleaners. And it shows women in a field. Now, it's realistic French gleaning in the 19th century, but not much different. What is a gleaner? A scrap picker. It's an understood role. There are reapers who come and harvest the crop, but it's understood that poor people will tag along behind picking up scraps and leftovers, and it was accepted. So that's her role. But I want you to know, so she is back now. She's come back. She's not in Moab anymore. She's in the land of Naomi. In fact, she's back in Bethlehem. Probably not an accident that it's Bethlehem. And there, she's in the fields. And she's gleaning. And then I want you to think about what happens. A man shows up. His name is Boaz. It's his fields. So, let me, verse 4, chapter 2, verse 4, she's in the fields gleaning, and behold, we get a behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. And he said to the reapers, not the gleaners, but to the reapers, this is what he says. The Lord be with you. Right? I read under the assumption that every detail matters. When this is included, it means something. He could have showed up and said, "How's it going today? Who's working hard? What are you stealing from me today? There are lots of choices he could have made in how he approached his workers when he first arrived. But this man shows up saying the Lord's name. The Lord be with you. See, I suggest to you that we're to see that in the fields of Boaz, God's order prevails. In the fields of Boaz, there is order, there is purpose, there is understanding. Part of the reason I know that is when he says this, the reapers don't grunt. Ooh. Look at the reaper's response, the Lord bless you. Now, whether they were trained by Boaz himself, or they learned it on their own, or this is their response. So you see that the verbal world here is the world of the blessing of the Lord. And this work is being done. See, now we're not in a time of famine. This is in the flourishing. And in this flourishing, here, God is made central. The very next thing he says, verse 5, then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers. See, now he's talking to something like we'd call a foreman or he says this. Also designed to repulse a modern ear and eye. Whose young woman is? Oh, I'm not anybody's young woman. It could just as well have been Yahoo. This is very clearly. The individuals belong. And if you don't get that out of this lesson, out of this book, then I think you've missed the point. Maybe I've missed the point. But here, see, no individual stands alone. Everybody belongs. Right? The assumption here is not that she belongs to a man. Maybe she belongs to a family. Back in East Texas, Saturday nights, high school boys go out. Parents say on the way, remember who you belong to, right? It mattered. It mattered. You're not an individual alone. That's what we see here, I think. And then this person knows. See, what I'd like you to think about also is that Boaz notices who's in his fields. And he knows who belongs there. And he notices somebody different and he asks. Now, is he eyeing attractive women? There is no hint of that. All we know is he knows. He knows his fields. And he knows what's happening there. And he asks about it. And he gets a report. And the report, look at this. Man, this will get you a raise by lunchtime. And he said, she is the young Moabite woman. See, again, she's the foreigner who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, please let me glean. So she came and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest. What a report. She's a hard worker. She's getting after it as a gleaner. And so Boaz speaks to Naomi and invites her to eat, to keep working, to invites her to stay near his young women. And let's see, and look in verse 10. Ruth, then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground and said, why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me? See, there it is, take notice of me, a foreigner. And Boaz knows exactly what to say right then. All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told. You're known. We know who you are. I didn't know how to connect you, but I knew the story. And then when I hear the connection, I know. I know who you are. I know what you've done. And look what he says. And this is, we're going to see this come back in a moment. So look in verse 12. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel. Now, this is not the God of Moab, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Astonishing. We're going to get back to that language as well. Look at this. Chapter 2, three times. In whose sight I shall find favor. That's early in the chapter when she goes out to glean. And then she asks, why have I found favor? And then in verse 13, I have found favor in your sight. You understand, this is the word that would be a counterpart to grace, I think. I've received something from you that I don't deserve. Why have I received this? And Boaz explains to her. But she understands I'm looking for someone in whose eyes I can find favor. In fact, in that same, and look in verse 13 where the third time occurs. Then she said, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant. You understand that spoken kindly, that's that word we see so often. That's Hesed language. You have spoken favorably. You have reached out to me. Something you didn't have to do. Though I am not one of your servants. Okay. And now we may get to my favorite detail. Verse 14. Come eat with the people. So she sits with the reapers, again, not with the gleaners. A very clear stratification, I believe. But she ate, in verse 14, she ate until she was satisfied. And then what does it say? The very end of verse 14, look at it. Remarkable. She had some left over. Ruth gets a to-go box. Remember that. This is an important detail. Once again, this is the language of flourishing. We're not scrimping. This is not famine. We're not living at the edge. And you have been brought into the flourishing. I'm going to provide you enough. I'm going to provide you extra. And we know this is important because later on when she goes home, when she takes the grain that she had gathered in her gleaning, takes it home. But we're also told that she shows Naomi the leftovers. So if you don't remember anything else, today when you go home after lunch, think about when you walk out with your little styrofoam container. Ruth got one too. Okay. That's astonishing. See here, this is the world of flourishing. And how do you flourish? Because you join the order of the world. Let me give you a word that we know. Our word economics has it its root. And think of ecology too. They have that same echo root, and you know what that is. That's the Greek word for household. Economics, in its root, is the rule of the household, the laws of the household. And here, see, this is in the household we flourish. And the word ecology shows us how broadly the word household can be stretched. Okay. In this world of the celebration, I want to mention one last detail from chapter 2. Well, I guess I better mention two things. In verse 20, the last word of verse 20 is redeemers. Boaz is a redeemer. See, we hear that word. See, there it is. This Jesus is our redeemer. But here, Boaz is a redeemer. So and again, you see how this is something of a microcosm, a small-scale counterpart of a larger enterprise. And so that's why Boaz becomes important. He is a redeemer. But in the verse 22, you see reference when Ruth is explaining to Naomi, she mentions how trouble could have come if you've gone somewhere else. So I use that as evidence in my mind once again to further establish the fact that the fields of Boaz are a place of safety, a place of order, a place of flourishing. And that's what is sought. And I want you to understand that's what we seek as well. Okay, let's go to the chapter 3. This is a weird scene. Chapter 3, we leave the field and we end up sometime later, this is not the same day, sometime later, ends up on the threshing floor where you're separating the wheat and the chaff, where you banging on them with mallet kind of instruments to separate, and then you, so, but apparently it's some kind of a ceremony or ritual, maybe just kind of a festivity where you're celebrating harvest, but he's there, they're eating and drinking and sleeping there. He may be trying to guard his crop, guard the harvest, but there he is at the threshing floor, and he's sleeping, and he's got a blanket. And Naomi tells Ruth, go to the threshing floor where he is. And then we get this amazing detail. It's weird. What do we do with it? Look in verse 4. These are the instructions. When he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet. Not uncover him, uncover his feet. Very specifically, uncover his feet. So she did just what Naomi said. Uncovered his feet. Why would she do that? And this in verse 8. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over. Behold, a woman lay at his feet. Behold. And she answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Look what she says. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. The language matters. Look at this. We noticed in chapter 2, Boaz used this language, commending her, noting what she had done. You have come from a foreign country, and you have come to take protection under the wings of the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Ladies and gentlemen, see, that's language that we could let resonate if we have enough kind of stretch in the Bible. Let me just show you quickly. Well, I'll just read a verse. You don't have to chase me there. In chapter 16 of Ezekiel, I hope you're paying attention. Okay, Brian. In verse 8, when I passed by you again and saw you, behold, lots of behold this morning, you were at the age for love, and I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I made my vow to you and entered into a covenant with you. So there, God spread the corner of his garment over Israel and entered into a covenant. See, so this is God talk. And by the way, if you want to go to one other place, you could go to Matthew 23, that famous passage of the seven woes unto you, scribes and Pharisees. But at the very end of that passage, Jesus says, and I'm in Matthew 23:37, but again, I'll just read it quickly for you. Jesus says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem. It's a lament. Oh, he's crying out. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often would I have gathered you children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. Here, the image is somewhat different, but got the chicken, but it's still under the wing. And apparently in the language, under the wing and covering with a corner of a blanket, two different kind of senses of the same word. So I want you to understand that Boaz uses the language. Ruth uses the language. They both understand what's going on here. You are invited to participate in this larger order. It's not about me, simply. It's not about you, simply. It's about this larger order, this economy of God, of which we are both a part. And it is in this economy that you and I can flourish. That's what we see. Now, so this is chapter 3. The verse 11, I want to note this because Boaz acts properly in this occasion. And he says, and now, my daughter, do not fear. This is chapter 3. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. Chapter 2, verse 1, Boaz is a worthy woman. Chapter 3, verse 11, Boaz is a worthy man. Ruth is a worthy woman. So these people are honorable. They're God-directed, God-prompted, God-motivated. They are worthy. In the same language, remember in Proverbs 31 about a worthy woman. So, and now he's ready to fulfill the role of the Redeemer. But, so she goes back home, tells Naomi what happened. The last verse of the chapter 3, Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. See, this has been triggered. This series of events has been triggered. And Boaz is going to do his part. He's going to fulfill his role as a potential redeemer. Chapter 4, first verse. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate. We're in the gate now. The gate is, of course, the kind of like the town square, right? Or it is the public meeting place. So I want you to understand that when Boaz comes here, three things are involved here. He's very precise in what he does. He's precise, he's pleasant, and he's public. This is not a trick behind closed doors. This is not deeds done in shadows. In the gate, he sits there, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So there more than one person is a Redeemer. In fact, there's a very clear hierarchy of Redeemerosity. And Boaz says to Ruth, I am a possible Redeemer. I understand that. But someone else is ahead of me in line. And I want you to know that I'm going to work it out, and I don't know how it'll play out, because it's not about me, and it's not about you. It's about this program that's bigger than both of us. And so this other Redeemer comes by, and what does Boaz say? Almost that same kind of, or the same spirit of the language, he says, turn aside, friend. Sit down here. This is no conflict. Friend, sit. And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. See, this is public. I've got witnesses. And then he says to this guy, this land is available, and you're a redeemer. And the guy says, I'll take it. And then he finds out it comes with a woman. He says, I can't take it. And again, I think this is when, like the other daughter-in-law, I don't think it's a condemnation of this other person. This is very pleasant. He says it would impair my other inheritance, the way he puts it. And so all is well. He said, we make a deal. I will become the Redeemer and fulfill the responsibilities of the Redeemer. And just to make sure you understand this is serious, take off my sandal and I hand it to you. So young people, the first time you buy a car, first time you close on a house, take off your shoe, hand it to the people, and they'll know you're serious. Or something else will happen. So, and it, so it works out. He fulfills the role and marries. But let's read in verse 11. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together, look at this, built up the house of Israel, built up the oikos, the economy of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. Now that's a really interesting, why that reference? But I'll leave that for another day when I have it figured out. Whom Tamar bore to Judah because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this woman. So you see this, you've been brought into this economy, and now the Lord is involved in this. I want you to know that this is before the wedding. So verse 13 though, so Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. So there is the, now, then in verse 15 of chapter 4, he shall be to you a restorer of life. Now here again, listen to this. These are the women of the village talking. This is when the serious things get done, like the baby showers and the wedding showers. The women are talking here. He shall, but he, and, she, and look, they're not talking to Ruth. They're talking to Naomi. This is bigger than one person. Maybe one of the problems we have with even with marriages. We think marriage is just two people, and it is two people getting married. But it's two people getting married in a community. and a company of witnesses. But look at the language. He shall be to you, Naomi, a restorer of life. Wow. This is not the foreign land famine, men around you dying. This is a restorer of land, a nourisher of your old age. Wow. What celebratory language. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. See, again, this is the language of connection. And then the way the book ends, the last three verses or so, four verses, you have a genealogy. What could be a better way to end? Now, most of us don't think about genealogies very much. As soon as we see a list of names, we collapse. And with maybe you understand, but maybe there's something more to learn here. And I think this is a perfect way to end, because now we see, once again, pointedly, explicitly, heavy-handedly, Ruth and their the family here, Obed here, they're not just left alone. It's not just this happy ending story of a marriage. They have a baby. It's cute. No. They are fit in. They're fit into the lineage of David. And David, of course, and Jesus is fit into the lineage of David. Fit into the kind of the likeness of David. Ruth is the great-grandmother of David. That's astonishing. Remember this. Virtually every time she's named in this book, she's Ruth the Moabite. She's a foreigner. But she's been brought in. Same way Rahab, foreigner brought in. Because they were drawn covenantally to the God of Israel. Let us be so drawn. All right, I got carried away and didn't advance things. But here we get to, this is the end. This is where you have the official number of points you're going to make. But I'm not going to reveal them to you once. I'll just show them all to you right there. There's nothing new. I've already said it all. But this is a reminder for those who like a handy list, who like a review. Hope you understand that my point, that's why it's not about Ruth. It's about the field. It's about the economy that Boaz creates. And not, of course, he doesn't create it alone, but he does intentionally participate in it in his own world. And that's where I think for us there is tremendous promise. You think this is weird old farming stuff. No. It is a beautiful, small-scale picture of what we can do. Because every one of us, in whatever its scale it might be, every one of us has the opportunity to create an order around us. And it can be part of God's order. Because it's clear, God is going to have an order. Remember, Ruth wants to be part of the life of Naomi, but also the life of her people, God's people. God. And so God's going to have an order. We can choose, like Boaz, to participate in it with our language, with our noticing of the world around us, with our shaping of the behavior within that world. So that's why I say not only is there an order, an economy of God, that order is carried out through people. Individuals make it happen. So it is the story of Ruth. It is the story of Boaz, but it's not simply their story. So I'm emphasizing the bigger picture, but I'm also wanting to not denigrate, not diminish the story of the individuals. Both are there. In fact, the third statement, the flourishing comes when we work God's order. Working God's order works. And we can do that, see, in your household. We can do that in this church. I hope you understand that we are a household of God. The New Testament tells us that. We are part of the household of God, and we get to promote flourishing. And when we do that, not only do we flourish, but people around us. It's an order that flourishes, not just me. So here's the odd thing. Sometimes we really do think about individuals getting saved, and we should. Because individuals need to get saved. Individuals need to have their sins washed away. Individuals do need to be rescued from the danger of hell. Individuals do need God. But that's not the end of it. That's the start. Because it is those saved individuals who become part of the economy of God. Those saved individuals, who, as we sang in one of our songs, they become a possession, a peculiar possession of God. And that's what we can do. We can flourish within God's order. So I hope you'll look around you this morning, right now. Look around you, see people. And you think, how can I help that person flourish? And there's a way. There's a way. If you notice, there's a way if you bring the language of Boaz into your own language. Those are at least some ways you can, by your speech and by your noticing and by your economic ordering, perhaps. So please join me in trying to think big about the possibility of community and the possibility of us flourishing. Now, of course, as I've said, for that to happen, individuals have to get right with God. And so it may be that there's someone among us this morning who really can't flourish in the presence of God because they have not been restored to a relationship with God. They've not made a relationship. And so here, you're invited. You're invited to know that your sin separates you, but you can do something about it. You can name Jesus as your Lord, and you can say, I'm ready to be shed of my sins. I want to confess two ways. I want to confess that Jesus is Lord, but then I want to confess that I want to be freed from my sins. And you can be a subject of baptism, and you can rise from the baptistry, washed from your sins, ready to enter into the community of God's people here. And as you know, I mean, as people here know, there will be a flourishing of hugs to greet you when you come out. If you need to respond somehow so you can be part of the full flourishing of God's people, please come now as we stand and as we sing.